Thanks for choosing this GLT podcast. While it's free to you, it's not free to produce. Take a moment and make a contribution to help pay for this program. Go to WGLT.org, and thanks.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Kids today don't seem to think much of the way adults are running things. That's according to State Senator Jason Berrickman.
You know, kind of a, we don't understand why you guys can't figure this out and resolve it. And then just a general frustration and lack of confidence in their government.
Senator Berrickman talks about his recent Youth Advisory Council meeting. Plus, orange is the new Barack. The Capitol steps have a jaded but very funny take of their own on government, John Norton reports. And a half century on, Rosemary's Baby is still stalking the popular culture. Laura Kennedy has more. That and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Senator Dick Durbin is pushing for tougher regulation of the e-cigarette industry. The senior Illinois Democrat is calling on the FDA to ban flavored e-cigarette products he says are deceptively marketed to kids. He says more than a quarter of Illinois high schoolers are now using e-cigs, also called vaping. Durbin raised his concerns yesterday during a visit to Advocate Bro Men in Normal. He also spoke to reporters about the Mueller investigation, the Trump administration's trade moves, and decriminalizing marijuana. GLT's Ryan Denham was there and has this report.
Is there any doubt in anyone's mind who they're marketing to and how they're marketing? They're selling to kids an addictive product. It's the same story that we went through with tobacco, cigarettes. So we've got to do more. I call on the FDA, and I know they've got their problems with statutes and regulations and timing and court challenges. But I've told them, you can't put this off. This has to be a priority. We're seeing millions of kids who are being lured into this addiction on a regular basis because of this flavoring. So they've started regulating products, including the Juul device, but they delayed their oversight for 5 years. 5 years? Where will we be in 5 years? I was pleading with Dr. Gottlieb, you can't wait 5 years, for goodness sakes, to get this done. In the last 4 years, e-cigarette use has increased among high school students by 300% nationwide. Where will it be in 4 or 5 years?
Senator Durbin, are you skeptical of e-cigarettes, even for adults, ostensibly as a smoking cessation tool?
If that were all that was happening, that adults were shifting from tobacco cigarettes to e-cigarettes, I'd have to say, well, I don't think it's a good choice, but it is an improvement on a bad choice. But when you have children being addicted, it's a totally different issue as far as I'm concerned. This addiction, as was mentioned earlier by Dr. Nevin, I believe by Camille, may lead from vaping to tobacco products instead of the other way. And that to me is the most insidious part of it.
The Democratic leader in the Senate, Chuck Schumer, recently came out in favor of decriminalizing marijuana. What do you think of that idea, and do you think it's a real possibility if Democrats were to win the Senate in November?
Well, I want to explore that. I want questions answered. I sat down with him before he announced it, and one of the things I suggested, I came out for medical marijuana, and I did because of the notion that if this chemical has a medical property that alleviates suffering or cures a disease, why would we treat it any differently than any other chemical that could do the same thing? That was my premise. Then I went to a medical marijuana clinic. I don't think many of my colleagues have done that, but one in Springfield. And I was kind of surprised what I saw. They took me back to a table and they said, okay, here is Leonardo da Vinci's man illustration. And here are arrows pointing to different parts of the body. And those arrows would say things like, if you suffer from headaches, you need THC-21A. If you suffer from a sore throat, then you need THC-46B. On and on and on. Overweight, take THC so-and-so. And I thought, and then you go to the next table where they say, which ones of these do you want to buy? And my question to them was, how do you connect up that particular medical problem with that strain of marijuana research? Where did you do the research? You didn't do it here. No, you can't do it here. You can't legally research the impact of marijuana products on a medical basis because it's a listed narcotic. Research in China. Research in Europe. So what I said to Schumer was, if we're going to move forward with this, and it appears America with 9 states already condoning recreational marijuana, can we at least invest some money into the medical side of this to understand if it has a property? Could you replace the use of opioid products with some form of marijuana? Is it better to do that? I don't know the answer to that. It's been suggested. So I asked him to put that in. So I start, I'm not diving headfirst into this issue. I've got a lot of questions to be asked and answered. I certainly understand the premise that smoking a joint shouldn't ruin your life with a criminal conviction. That to me is ridiculous, and I've seen it happen. And I've seen people disqualified from a lifetime appointment to the federal bench because they smoked a marijuana cigarette after they graduated from law school. Seriously, that disqualified a person from being considered for a federal judgeship. That's mindless. So I have a kind of open mind about this, but I want some questions answered.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Senator Durbin spoke to reporters Tuesday in Normal. He was asked about this week's trip to Beijing by the Trump administration's top trade officials.
Well, I worry about this issue because I don't think our trade relationship with China has been good. I think we have a trade deficit with that country that has been growing. Their manipulation of currency gives them an advantage which even our best producers can't overcome. So certainly we have our trade issues with China and should pursue them aggressively at a number of different levels. But the loose talk and tweets about trade wars not hurting really ignore the obvious. The first casualties in a trade war are farmers. They're the ones who depend for 25% to 50% of their income on exports. And if we have a trade war which excludes soybeans to China or corn to another country, the net result of it is going to be felt right here in Illinois first and foremost. If NAFTA went away, our corn exports would be dramatically impacted, and the corn prices are too low already. So let's take care to do this in a thoughtful, responsible way, without the name-calling, without the tweets. Let's lead this to a negotiation where we do it honestly and realize we can't win on every issue. The Chinese still want to export to us, but we want fairness when it comes to our exports to them.
The Senate Judiciary Committee voted last week to approve a bipartisan bill to protect Special Counsel Robert Mueller from being fired, despite warnings from Senate leaders that the bill is unlikely to receive a full vote in the Senate. I asked Senator Durbin, who sits on that committee, whether it's a symbolic move or if he thinks it has a real chance of reaching the Senate floor.
Senator McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, has said he will not let it reach the Senate floor. That's unfortunate. It passed out of the committee 14-7, bipartisan roll call, and it said not just this independent counsel, but all future independent counsels will be protected from being terminated without cause. And there is a process where you can take it to a court to make the final judgment as to whether cause exists. So it was precipitated by the current situation, but it applies way beyond it. I think it is a sensible way to approach this topic. But I don't believe that McConnell will let it come to the floor. I think he thinks it's too divisive in his own caucus.
Durbin also responded to a report being released this week by Governor Rauner's task force on the Quincy Veterans Home, which has been hit by an outbreak of Legionnaires' disease. Durbin says he doesn't think it's time to go to President Trump for help on the issue, although he says there is a role for the federal government to play.
I read the preliminary report and the options, and I think that any good solution involves rebuilding some of the facilities there. Some of them are ancient, and they're preserved for historic purposes, but they don't serve the medical needs of the veterans and their families effectively, and sadly, they are dangerous. The plumbing in these buildings is so old that the Legionnaires' bacteria, which was detected in 2015, reappeared in 2017, and they did the DNA. It was the identical bacteria. They had gone back to look and said, we never got rid of it. Despite 2 years of effort. So it's time to concede the obvious. They put filters upon filters in place now, and they seem to have a safe supply that can see them through the transition. The good news is the federal government, the U.S. Veterans Administration, will pay for 65% of the cost of construction. We have grants for that purpose. And I've said that to the governor, as Senator Duckworth and I both want to stand by anyone who is ready to try and alleviate that danger at the Quincy Veterans Home.
That's Senator Dick Durbin speaking at Advocate Broman in Normal. I'm Ryan Denham.
See more from Durbin's e-cigarettes push in Normal, including comments from an Advocate Broman doctor, at our website, WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from the Mike Thornton Agency, presenting the musical and political comedy satire of the Capitol Steps at the BCPA Sunday, May 13th at 3 p.m. Mentioning GLT when you call the box office for tickets will give you a special rate. Tickets at 309-434-2777. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a scary movie. No, not that scary movie. Rosemary's Baby. And now for the stay off of my lawn. Kids today, grumpy old fogey man section of Sound Ideas. No, not really. It's just a little more optimistic than that. State Senator Jason Berrickman says kids today are just as frustrated as adults as the effectiveness of government. But he tells GLT there are some differences. Berrickman talks about a recent meeting of his Youth Advisory Council.
So this is, really interesting because you hear from these young people. These are 16 to maybe 18-year-olds. They're in high school. And the message that I've heard continually, I've done this program maybe for 5 years, the message that I continue to hear from them is, number one, concern about the budget and the financial state of affairs of the state of Illinois. You know, kind of a, we don't understand why you guys can't figure this out and resolve it. And then just a general frustration and lack of confidence in their government. And it's, what you see in them is less interest in political parties. I mean, they're young people today don't necessarily want labels like being a Republican or a Democrat, but they really care about issues. And I think it's going to be really interesting to watch this generation of young people move into, this is a group of people who by and large can't even vote yet, but they soon will be able to, and it'll be interesting to see how their transition to adulthood impacts the government that's supposed to serve and represent people, including them.
What do you tell them about a lack of faith in government, a lack of belief that government can do its intended functions?
Well, number one, and part of the reason for the program is to inspire them to serve in public office or to get involved in government and politics to make it better. I mean, that's the way the system works. You don't like what you've got, step forward. If you don't step forward, someone else will, and they're going to make decisions on your behalf. So part of it is designed to be inspiring of that. The other part of it is for them to learn how the structure of government sometimes creates these dysfunctional outcomes. I come on your program. I've been very critical of the way in which Illinois draws its legislative districts. Well, the result of that unfair map-making process is all the Democrats get packed in certain districts, all the Republicans get packed in other districts.
Safe seats for both sides.
Right. And both sides then are forced to appeal to their primary voters as opposed to appealing to the moderates and the independents who really determine competitive elections and general elections. We don't have enough of that, competitive elections in that general election vote. We don't have enough of those. And the result is we send people to the state capitol, we send people to the General Assembly who come from districts that are heavily weighted to one political party or the other, and you don't get the outcome that everyone wants. The outcome that I hear by and large from people around the state is we want our government to work. We recognize that it's divided today, Democrat control in the legislature, Republican control in the governor, the executive branch. We want to see the two sides come together, work together, problem solve, you know, move our state forward, but they're not getting that result. And I think the maps is the number one reason why we're getting the results that we are.
How do you see them? You mentioned that they are taking things issue by issue, but how do you see them developing or groping toward the formation of their own philosophies of government?
Well, I think that for a lot of young people, you know, much of their views get first molded by their parents and some of the experiences they have in the home. I think that the folks that teach them have a significant impact on them. But, you know, by the time they hit high school, and especially when they hit, you know, college campuses like ours here, they are really searching for information. And there's a ton of information out there today. You know, it used to be, you know, radio and newspapers and TVs were our only outlets. And as you know, there are many other manners in which you can get information on all sorts of things. Because that information's at a young person's fingertips, I think they're using that. It's expanding kind of their worldview. And, you know, it all goes into the melting pot of our brain, and they come out with ideas and philosophies and otherwise.
So are you saying that they're more fully formed than previous generations were at that age?
Well,
I
only know my own experience, right? I know that when I was in high school, how's this, Charlie? When I hit college, when I hit the ISU campus, I remember starting to read a newspaper, and I remember being told that I should read a weekly periodical of news. I think I read Newsweek at the time.
Standard advice for any prof worth their salt.
Yeah, there you go. So today, though, that limited manner of getting information, number one, it sounds ridiculous. And number two, we know that young people are getting information by the minute. They get it on a Facebook feed. They get it on a Twitter feed. And so I do think there's more information in front of them, or there's more information available to them. You know, whether they click the article and actually read it, I think a lot of students do. And again, that presents more information in their brain to consider as they consider events, whether they be worldly events or, you know, events within our state.
State Senator Jason Barrickman is a Republican from Bloomington.
Hi, my name is R.C. McBride. I've only been a GLT for a couple of years, but I've been working in media for more than 25, and much of that in my early days was as a news reporter. And it turns out I'm real, not fake. I didn't wake up one day and think, I'm going to start doing fake news. In fact, it's counterproductive to do anything like that for a public radio audience which hungers for and is willing to financially contribute toward real, fact-based reporting. We let you decide what to think and how much to contribute. Please contribute now at WGLT.org. Support for GLT comes from the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation, a grant-making organization committed to helping you meet your philanthropic goals through donor-advised funds, endowments, scholarships, and more. More information at ilprairiecf.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, the challenges the Trump administration presents to political comedians. This past weekend, Twitter users were titillated by a remarkable coincidence. When Kate Middleton debuted her newborn royal son, she wore a red dress with a white lace Peter Pan collar. The dress was identical to the one worn by Mia Farrow in the classic film Rosemary's Baby. Spawn of Satan jokes aside, the excited comparison showed that even 50 years after the film hit the silver screen, it's still stalking our culture's subconscious. Laura Kennedy has more.
Rosemary's Baby is not your everyday, the monster walks kind of horror film. In fact, it may not even be construed as a horror film at all. That's according to Sherry Zeck, interim dean of Illinois State University's Milner Library and GLT's culture maven. The Roman Polanski film is 50 years old this year and stars John Cassavetes and Mia Farrow as a young couple who unfortunately become friends with the devil worshippers next door. Zek says although the plot concerns the machinations of the devil worshippers and the young woman upon whom they prey, Polanski didn't make a true horror film, but more like a Hitchcockian classic suspense film, elevating the scary movie to a new and more sophisticated level.
If you think about it, the only monstery kind of thing is the rape scene. And not that that's small, but it is not a film in which monsters are popping out at every moment, or there are people with knives running around, or any of those things that seems to be the distinguishing point between a suspense film and a horror film. It's by and large operating under the threat of something that has happened, or the results of something that has happened, or the threat of something new happening. If we put it in terms of suspense, then no, he's not elevating the genre. He's following in line with one of the great masters. But if we put it in line with, say, 50s horror films, then yes, it's taking it to a new artistic level.
Now, this was based on a book that came out just about a year before Polanski made the film.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a good success. So naturally, you want to make a film out of a successful book. But what else about this movie is important, why it got made at this time in the late 1960s? What was Polanski exploring that was significant to that time period with regards to the devil and his impending child's birth?
What's going on in culture is a countercultural movement.
Wait a minute. Is the devil the ultimate counterculture?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Paganism is, I'm not going to say it's on the rise, but it is being considered by more and more white middle-class Americans. This isn't quite the era of the New Age, but it's the proto-New Age era, peace, love, and understanding. Now, those are not the things that we associate with the devil, but if we think of them as opposed to a Christian hierarchy, then there certainly was a whole lot of America who saw those hippies as the work of the devil. Right. So I think that this is definitely some kind of comment on the dark side of counterculturalism and an anxiety, a fear of what might be operating beneath the surface of nice middle class America.
Was there also fear of youth in general in this? We have these wonderful older characters in the film. The characters themselves aren't wonderful. The actors are wonderful. You've got Ralph Bellamy.
Mm-hmm.
You also have Ruth Gordon. And Sidney Blackmer is in it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And these were actors who really rose to fame in the 1930s. And they're playing these characters that are part of a witch's coven. Mm-hmm. And they're very powerful. So is there a generational thing that's going on in this movie?
Yes, but you know, one of the interesting twists on that is, you're right. On the one hand, we have this kind of older generation hearkening back to these ur values of devil worship and creepy stuff, preying upon these young people, first on a single young woman and then on this young couple. But at the very end, when the international aspect of the coven comes in, then there are young people in the coven who appear in the last sequence who are significantly younger than everyone else in this coven. So there's also this weird kind of hint of this birth of this devil child being an avenue for that generation to be bridged, for a new generation of the devil worshiping coven to be born.
Let's talk about the character of Rosemary, who I actually found kind of frustrating, and maybe it's because, you know, I'm a modern 21st century person, but I wanted to grab her and shake her because she so often was ignoring signs in this movie and not trusting her own intuition. She was acquiescing to her husband so much, and it just sort of drove me crazy. And I just felt like if you just listened to your gut instinct, you wouldn't have been, you know, carrying the devil spawn.
Well, her gut is filled with the devil. Let's not forget that. All right. I'm going to make a confession to you.
Oh.
I just watched the film this week and I've never seen it before.
Oh.
I believe I have confessed to you in the past that these movies scare me and I can't sleep at night. And so I had to I certainly didn't watch it when I was 8. And I didn't watch it when I was a film scholar because really that creepy stuff, can I just read about it and not have to actually watch it and have it infiltrate my dreams as it did this week, even though I watch it during the day. So very susceptible to these kinds of movies is Little Sherry. But in watching it this week, one of the things that surprised me was actually how strong she was. How pretty early on in the film, she knows something's not right with this pregnancy. As much as she wants a baby, as much as she's dreaming of naming her child and all that kind of stuff, she keeps insisting something's wrong. And she starts not drinking the magic Ruth Gordon potion and that sort of stuff relatively soon. Then we get to the point where she insists on having this party, even though everyone tells her not to. She adamantly refuses to let Ruth Gordon come to the party. So I think she's a much feistier, stronger figure than my notion of Rosemary was. However, within that, she was raped and her husband arranged the rape. And I think what I feel lacking is her outrage, her incredible outrage about it. And even before it's revealed to her, if not to us, that she's been raped by the devil, her husband raped her. He admits the next day, basically. She says it felt like a rape. I believe she actually uses that word. And there are the scratches on her body, and he, you know, makes this disgusting remark about how she was unconscious and he was still in the mood and it was actually kind of hot that way. He's horrible from the get-go.
Yeah.
But in that moment, right, that's the moment where we want to say, okay, you tell him goodbye now.
He's an actor, and he's basically sold his soul, and he gets the success. And I have to wonder if Polanski's saying something about actors who become famous.
But of course, this is an old story. Person who sells themselves to the devil for wealth, fame, intelligence, money, you know, that's an old, old story. He sells his wife. He sells his wife.
Yes.
It's not his life that ultimately becomes ruined because of this pact with the devil. It's his wife's. So that's where the real, I think, significant shift in the story. And Polanski himself has said that Pharaoh in her physiognomy and her looking frail, looking mild, really brought a kind of vulnerability to the role that then became the role and moved it in a certain direction. And I think that one of the things that works in this as a movie, though it grates, one of the things that works in this as a movie is how her own physical frailty, her vocal, the quality of her voice, all those sorts of things help us to see her as a victim and victimizable. And thus, perhaps that is part of why I find notable about the film how she works against those things.
So the film was successful.
Yes.
And it also, pardon the expression, spawned more Devil Children films. So do we see this as really sort of the granddaddy of the Devil Children films that came to follow, like The Omen that we had a few years later?
Yes. There were films that in the late 50s and early 60s, there were a few films that had Devil Children in them, as it were, or at least extremely badly behaving murderous children.
Like the bad seed.
Yes, whether they were really the child of the devil or not. But this literalization of the devil is something that we then see a flurry of films about. The most obvious ones are The Omen and Damien. And
so in films like this, do we see children as sort of a blank slate onto which we project our fears?
Yes. I think in some ways that's what a lot of film characters are. The spectator that is presumed in a film is an adult, right? So I think when it is a child or children in whom evil is imbued, it's also about a loss of us, our fears about a loss of power and the future, not just children, but the future swallowing us up and ruining us. So it's a fear of a changing world
so if
that
maybe,
we don't feel safe in anymore.
The fear of the unknown and maybe the fear of getting old and the children taking control.
The children taking control, and they're not good like we are. I think one other thing that's interesting to note that we would be remiss if we didn't note about Rosemary's Baby, because we've kind of focused on what was done to her. The devil is living inside her. It is within her body. The dangers are around her, but the devil is in her body now. And her body is also turning against her as a result of a rape. Let's be clear, as a result of a rape. It's 1968, and she literally says at one point when they're asking her to see a different doctor, she says literally, "I'm not going to have an abortion." That word was said out loud. It brings absolutely to the fore the question of a woman's control of her body in a way that I think is remarkable. And of course, Roe v. Wade is only a few years later. So though if you watch the film in sort of a flat way, it's much more about this older generation, the husband who sells her out for rape, the classic story of selling your soul to the devil, only this time he's selling his wife to the devil, all those things. But there is an element in there that is the question of a woman's relationship to an alien within her, a baby as an alien, a baby as a burden, a baby as not a part of her, but a thing that's been done to her. And what is her relationship to that? And that's also why I think the ambiguity of that final scene is so important. The film doesn't show her cuddling this child, but it certainly hints that she is going to overcome her terror because the pull of motherhood is greater than anything else. The pull of motherhood is greater than knowing you've given birth to the devil, knowing that your husband has prostituted you out, and knowing that you've been raped by the devil. All of those things, the fact that she was sick and pale as death herself through her pregnancy, all of those things become irrelevant in the face of, I'm a mother and this is my child.
That's Sherry Zeck, interim dean of Illinois State University's Milner Library and GLT's Culture Maven. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Rosemary's Baby spawned a sequel, Look What Happened to Rosemary's Baby, a 1976 TV movie, plus an unsuccessful 2014 miniseries remake of the original film. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The Trump administration and the maturing of social media has forced the Capitol steps to be more flexible in writing their political comedy while traveling from city to city. That's according to founding member Elena Newport. Speaking with GLT's John Norton via Skype ahead of the Capitol steps appearance at the BCPA May 13th, Newport says the founding of the comedy troupe has an Illinois connection.
The Capitol steps started as a Senate office Christmas party. We were working for Senator Charles Percy from Illinois, and he was one of those Republican moderates that you only read about now in history books. You never find them in the wild anymore.
Yeah, no kidding.
So we were truly just, okay, what are we going to do at this year's Christmas party? We worked up a few songs. It was the early days of Reagan. It was kind of a fun time. And we thought somebody would tell us to stop or fire us or both, because here we were making fun of the people that employed us. But Percy was very nice. He invited us to perform at many events at his house. He was a good sport, and he didn't tell us to stop. So here we are.
So how much flack have you gotten over the years? I mean, have you gotten any for doing what you're doing and knowing the people that you're making fun of?
Well, you know, we fully expected that. We fully expected that we would get lots of complaints, you know, stop doing this here, you know, don't, you know, respect your employers, all that. And that was one of the big surprises over the years, is that a lot of the presidents that were in office while we were around invited us to perform. Reagan, Clinton, both, we've performed for both Bushes. And the only senator who ever got really mad was Alphonse D'Amato from New York. And he came up to me after a show one time, and he was mad because we didn't have a song about him.
Really? Oh.
Yeah,
oh.
That was it. That was like the worst thing you could do to certain politicians is ignore him or her. Oh. Just, you know.
So do you have some of those politicians or their staffers come up and say, you know, here's an idea for, you know, Senator X, or right?
No, George Bush Sr. Was probably the one who was friendliest to us. And he actually got up on stage with us once or twice and sang. I use the term loosely. But it was great sport. And after we performed for Reagan, he came up on stage and he said, "No, thank you very much. Now you're all under arrest." So, you know, he had that great timing, the comedic timing, and it was a fun event.
So are you guys all former staffers or current staffers, a little bit of both?
We have all left our day jobs against all advice. They started to notice we weren't showing up a lot of days. Like, I worked on the Hill for 7 years while I also did the Capitol steps. And there, we would start to travel and people would notice, "Hey, where's Elena today?" And I got away with that for a while. But then, you know, unless you're the actual politician, you can't do that for long.
Well, everything has changed in the last couple of years, hasn't it? And I mean, I'll give you one word and you go with it, right? Trump.
Well, yeah. It is. The news cycle is so fast. You know, in some ways, Trump is good for business. In other ways, it's just exhausting because you try to stay ahead of this guy. It's almost impossible. I remember during the campaign, I was thinking, well, this guy's pretty funny. And I think I'll write a joke where he goes out and he says, "I never kiss babies on the campaign trail. Babies are losers. Get a job, babies." You know, and I thought, okay, that's an exaggeration of something he might say. But then a couple weeks later, he actually got into a fight with a baby at a campaign rally and kicked the baby out because the baby was crying. So yeah. Then I'm like, well, I give up.
I remember that. Yeah. So you have to adapt pretty quickly to what's going on in today's news cycle. Are you able to keep up with that? Do you try to keep up with that? Or where do you draw the line on that?
Well, you know, sometimes you really are wondering whether a story will hang in the news long enough to be funny 6 months later or even a day later. So I have been known to occasionally text a joke to someone standing backstage waiting to go on. But that's kind of unusual. That's if something really big happened and you have to say something about it. But a lot of these stories, like the Russia scandal and the partisan bickering, have hung in the news for months and months and will. And, you know, Putin's not going anywhere. And he's been in our show for several years. And I did mention the shirtless thing, so I want to do a partial nudity warning here.
Well, this is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. We're talking with Elena Newport, a founding member of Capital Steps, who are at the BCPA here real soon. Now, I know you do more than Donald Trump, but I mean, what are some of the other challenges you face in the Trump era and the social media era?
We try to keep our show bipartisan, so that's been a challenge because the party in power is always a little bit funnier, and we always have lots about whoever's running the White House, and especially if they're running the Senate and the Congress, too. But we make a great effort in our show to have, you know, we'll have Bernie Sanders out there. He's not going away. That's good. We have Elizabeth Warren in the show. We have Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer in the show. So we're always looking for ways to make the show bipartisan and kind of, you know, we'll get the guy you like in the first song and the guy you don't like in the second song.
How do you make Bernie Sanders funny?
Well, you get him out there and you have him singing a show tune. You try getting a wig that's bad enough for Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump. So we have him singing If There Were No Rich Men, that was one of our Bernie songs, to If I Were a Rich Man.
Okay.
And, I always like to say, if you've ever wanted to see Donald Trump sing a rock song and Bernie Sanders sing a show tune and Vladimir Putin dance shirtless, this is the show for you because you will not see that anywhere else.
So as the Capitol Steps, a comedy troupe, were you licking your chops when Donald Trump was elected or were you going, I mean, in some ways it's very helpful, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, unless there's a nuclear war, and then that's probably hard for everybody.
Yeah.
So, and sometimes it's hard to make fun of nuclear war, although we do have a song right now called How Do You Solve a Problem Like Korea about the talks that are coming up.
Any chance you're taking a stab at this year's White House Correspondents' Dinner that just passed as we're talking?
You know, it's funny you should mention that because we performed it that years ago, before it was like something that anybody even knew about. Back during the Clinton years, and we performed for it a couple times. And I don't remember getting the kind of press that Michelle Wolf is getting. But, you know, our show is a lot of puns, wordplay. A lot of times the songs that we write about somebody could do right in front of that person. So, you know, it's all in good fun.
Well, you mentioned it's a bipartisan staff. I mean, are you including libertarians and socialists in that as well, or is that just Democrats and Republicans?
So, that's true. That's true. We have, in our cast, we have all political stripes, from the most liberal to the most conservative. And we have lively discussions backstage, But we keep the show bipartisan, and everybody goes out and they do what their role or what their script says, unless they forget the words.
So. Elena Newport, founding member of the Capital Steps, is joining us via Skype on GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. Well, we kind of touched on this, but progressives over the last few years especially have tried to pull the Democratic Party to the left, right? And beginning in about 2009-10, the Tea Party began pulling the Republicans to the right, and they probably pulled the Republican Party farther to the right than progressives have had success pulling to the left. But does the fact that these parties are, you know, so far apart now, does that make it easier to write material?
Well, I don't know if it makes it easier, but I think it makes it more important that we do this because, you know, everybody had that experience after the election of trying to have a conversation at their Thanksgiving dinner table with relatives that felt very differently than they did. And it was very unpleasant and partisan and the fights on Facebook and all that. And we were really kind of concerned about it. And so the best compliment that we got after that election was people coming up to us after the show and saying, you know, I wasn't sure I could laugh, but I did and I feel better.
What's something new in the show that you might want to tip us off to that that people might get a kick out of?
Well, let's see. We've got a song that we're just working up about Paul Ryan leaving. Hang Down Your Head, Paul Ryan, about getting out of all of this. We've got Melania singing, telling why she loves Donald in spite of the Stormy Daniels. We've got her singing, I Want a Man with a Small Hand, about why she loves Donald. We've got Stormy in the show, an exclusive Stormy Weather cover. And all the characters that are in the headlines, there's going to be 30 songs and skits in the show. It's not going to be just Trump. It's going to be almost everybody you can think of. Betsy DeVos, Ben Carson, Elizabeth Warren, even fake news people like Wolf Blitzer. So it's going to be people running on and off stage, grabbing wigs, changing accents, doing songs, about 30 songs and skits in an hour and a half.
Capital Steps founding member Elena Newport speaking with GLT's John Norton. The comedy troupe's latest show is titled Orange is the New Barack. The Capital Steps appear at the BCPA in downtown Bloomington May 13th. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The average green bean is just that, average. Time up your green bean growing game. Patrick Murphy has an idea for you on this edition of GLT's Grow.
Don't plant just any old bean this year. Go with the delicious and distinctive Dutch heirloom known as the Dragon Tongue Bean. I'm Laura Kennedy, and this is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert in the field. From the Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum, it's Patrick Murphy. Hey, Murph.
Hi, Laura.
Today on GLT's Grow, growing dragon tongue beans. And these are beautiful, beautiful beans.
They are as fashionable as a bean could get. And I've never seen a dragon's tongue, but I imagine that's what it looks like. I've seen types of stitching that's described as a dragon's tongue. But maybe they call this a dragon's tongue because of its color, Laura. I don't know.
What's its color?
It's yellowy with purple stripies.
Oh, that sounds nice.
I know. And like you said, it's a Dutch heirloom, and we love to send our Grow corporate love out to our friends in Menominee Falls, Wisconsin, where there's a sign that says, if you ain't Dutch, you ain't much. But that is only referring to tourists coming to Menominee Falls. About the heirloom bush or snap bean, it resembles the shape and overall size of your regular French green bean. And the plant itself is very compact. Since it's a bush.
Oh, wait a minute. Does this mean I can plant this if I've got a really tiny yard? This might be the bean to go with?
I think it's a great fit. I was just going to say it's a great small space crop. I was unable to make a determination of what its success is like in a container, but I know that there are many other gardeners that are growing various bush beans, buckwheat, black-eyed peas. They're all growing them in pots. So let's give it a try.
Why not?
Let's give it a try. And it's considered a culinary superstar, Laura, also.
Why?
Because its appearance and its flavor. So there are a couple pests. We got to get the pests and the control thing out of the way. They're typical pests for Green beans would be the Mexican bean beetle or bean weevils. Easy to control.
How do we do that?
Culture is one way. Don't let them get all bedraggled and wilty, because a stressed plant attracts the pest a lot of times.
Uh-huh.
And plant more than one. Have several so you got the pollination source. And don't do anything crazy like plant them in the shade. Plant them in the blazing hot sun where they can mound.
Huh?
They mound, yes. Ah. They're really neat. And another reason that they're a culinary superstar is that they have a taste that seems very popular on the palate, and it's kind of a nutty taste, a nutty, buttery taste. Because we've talked about the Red Vikings and the German butterball potatoes. Man, would that be good to put together with this bean, because
you could have a succotash.
Yeah, and then this bean, another reason for it being called a culinary superstar is because it's very low in the little fibers, the little hairy type things that are along the ridge of the bean. And it's more of the consistency of a wax bean, so it's a meaty bean.
Ooh.
Rather than one that kind of pastes, you know. If you've ever made the hillbilly hash with the green beans and the potatoes and bacon grease, the green beans a lot of times just turn into like a paste. You could literally spread it on a piece of bread.
Uh-huh.
And that reminds me also of the dragon tongue, the bean that's inside the pod, is unusual in appearance also. So it's white with the little teeny tiny purple hash marks on it. So inside and out, it's really quite distinctive. And I was thinking about, well, how would one enjoy this, right?
Yeah,
how would one enjoy it?
Good ways. I mean, could I just eat it raw, do you think?
It is recommended that you eat it served chilled after soaking it in water in the refrigerator for 24 hours, and that lessens the snap a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You can also blanch them. That's not Maud's sister, but blanching is where you kind of boil it briefly and then you pour some warm water over it and you're ready to eat them. And if you cook this bean and it turns white, you have overcooked it.
Oh, good tip there. Okay, you're listening to GLT's Grow, our weekly gardening show for those who like to get their hands dirty. This week, growing the delicious and beautiful dragon tongue beans.
So growing them is important. It is important to avoid the last frost. They're very cold weather sensitive.
Okay, what do you do?
So you wait, I would say, a week or two after the last frost hazard. So some people look that up with extension, USDA.
Mm-hmm.
Some people use the almanac. I think a safe date is Mother's Day.
Yes.
Okay, so you could wait until Mother's Day weekend or right after that and plant this in the full sun. And it is a plant that does not need a lot of fertilizer, so you could just do some composting when you plant it, and you would not have to do any fertilizing for that season.
Really?
Yes. And it's recommended that water-soluble fertilizers are used because they're kind of mild, and this bean is a light feeder, as it were. I just, when I have looked at the images of this vegetable, I've seen the dishes that it came with, and it is undeniably appetizing in appearance. And I like a lot of other vegetables and plant-type foods that have that nutty taste. You know, your morel mushroom.
Mm-hmm.
Some potatoes have that flavor. I do like the black-eyed peas. I think they have kind of they're buttery tasting, but they're sharp at the same time.
Okay.
This sounds so cool, so amazing. And every little dish, every little image of them from 4-H and other state fair competitions showed this bean in all of its glory. Some have a little more yellow, some have a little more purple.
Mm-hmm.
That must be the differences in the culture, right? Different soil types, different water levels, things like that.
It's a very Instagrammable bean. So if you've got a good Instagram account and you like to shoot your garden or what you're having for dinner, this would be a perfect bean for that. You'll get a lot of likes, a lot of double tapping on that bean.
Yeah, so when we say it's a culinary superstar because of flavor and appearance, but it's also photogenic.
Yes.
So we can say it's a very photogenic bean that demands a higher salary and lots of perks and all the green M&Ms removed from the green beans.
Okay.
From the bowl.
Yeah.
But it's just really remarkable that there's always something new out there. And I'm not saying this is new, but it's new to me. And I would like to give it a try. Maybe it's something we can consider offering at the Fell Arboretum plant sale in the future
someday. That's not a bad idea. Are they hard to find?
I do not think so. I found multiple seed suppliers that have it. Seed Savers Exchange had it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of mail order seed providers and nursery suppliers have this plant.
So I would really have to start from seed with this. It's not like a tomato where I could go find a half-grown plant and just go right into my garden. I should start from seed.
Yeah, and I don't see the advantage from starting it from a plant, really.
Really?
The seed's
okay.
Probably very inexpensive, and it sounds pretty straightforward. You know, you're not trying to sneak this in early like a carrot or a potato, right? The below-ground vegetables. This one's just keep it away from the frost and keep it watered. You don't have to go crazy spraying it or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an attractive plant, actually. So if you had a small space garden where you're mixing your edibles along with your ornamentals, I would say you could absolutely do it.
Really? Like, do the leaves look nice?
They are. Nice little soft spade-shaped leaves that come to a gentle point. And because its habit is mounding, it appears as though it kind of shades itself in the beans that it grows.
Oh, that's so interesting.
And that's a little bit on the common side for a bean, you know, for whether it's a pole bean or a bush bean.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes, that's where you might find the beans, a little bit in the shade that the plant provides itself.
And if you're having a dinner party and you want to impress people, this might be the bean to serve, because it's not terribly commonplace yet. So it could be a great way to impress your friends.
I think it would be a great table conversation starter.
Okay. Next week, coming up on GLT's Grow, we have a spring to-do list for you for work in the garden. If you've got a gardening question you'd like Murph to take on, go to our website, wglt.org, fill in the form, and send it along to us. Submit those online again at our website, wglt.org/Grow.
You can subscribe to the GLT Grow podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. With help today from Laura Kennedy, Ryan Denham, and John Norton. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM.